EDD has been failing California. My colleagues, my staff, and I are at wit's end. Our constituents are depleting their life savings, going into extreme debt, having trouble paying rent, and putting food on the table.
San Francisco Democratic Assemblyman David Chu speaking at a contentious budget hearing yesterday. State lawmakers met to discuss the backlog of nearly a million unemployment claims here in California. The hearing revealed that the state's unemployment office, he referred to it as EDD, it's the Employment Development Department, received around 11 million calls in June. Just in 1 month. Most of them were not answered by a real person. And as the state tries to hammer out the problems with its unemployment system, there is looming panic at the federal level. Today, the extra $600 in federal unemployment support expires. Well, joining us now is a woman who is still trying to get her unemployment money, Astu Ba. She's using a nickname because she's afraid of repercussions. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, guys.
You were a rideshare driver and you haven't worked since March. And so you went to file for unemployment. And what happened?
Well, I started my unemployment application back in March 15th. And then it didn't go through. The website kept crashing. And they said the EDD website wasn't like ready for all the applications until April 11th. That's when my application went through. 2 days later, I received like an award letter letting me know that I do qualify for unemployment, but my benefit was zero since I'm a rideshare driver. That Lyft and Uber don't provide EDD with our financial records.
Did you appeal?
Yes, I did appeal. I sent them my 1099s, everything they needed. They asked for proof of residency, proof of citizenship and everything. I send it to them via USPS, and then I faxed them some documents because they didn't answer until now, basically, because I only got through the phone with EDD in July 10th.
Wait, so how long had you been calling? Since April?
Since April, I've been calling because I sent them all the documents and never got any response.
So basically 2 months you were trying to get through and you didn't get through.
Yes.
How many calls did you make?
Just in 1 day, I made 700 calls to EDD.
In 1 day?
In 1 day.
How is that possible?
I dialed 700 times. No answer. The machine kept answering and hanging up. I called back. My sister and I, we were just doing that. And then at the end of the day, we were tired and we just gave up.
You have two small children at home, ages 6 and 4. Have you?
Yes.
How do you support them if you have not received any benefits in all this time?
Well, I don't even know how much I have in debt right now. And my parents, poor them, send me some money from Africa, which is ridiculous because I'm the one supporting them. Wow. And I can even, sometimes we eat pizzas from Costco because it's cheaper and it's a huge pizza. We can have that for lunch and dinner, my kids and I. I just pay $10.99, and I have a huge pizza. That's how we've been basically, I can even buy fruits for my kids. It's just, it's ridiculous.
That's so sad and so frustrating because you've earned these benefits as a worker because you've paid into the state taxes and the unemployment taxes, and this is what it's for. It's been incredibly difficult. You're an immigrant from West Africa. Have you ever considered or thought in your darkest moments of just packing it in and going back home?
Yes, but how? Everything is closed. Airports are closed. Borders are closed. There's nowhere to go. I've thought about it. My parents been telling me to go back because at least there I have a roof. I have a roof over my head and I don't have to worry about rent.
So you would be better off in West Africa, in the West African country of Guinea, where you're from, than in the richest country in the world.
Definitely. Right now in this situation. Definitely.
Wow. Well, I wish you all the luck in the world and I hope things turn out for you and things get better. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me, Guy. You have a great day.
You too. All right, let's add in Jay Obernolte to this conversation. He's a Republican assemblyman who represents parts of San Bernardino County. And as you were listening to that, assemblyman, what crossed your mind? What did you think?
Oh, it's heartbreaking. But, you know, that poor woman's story is a story that we hear over and over and over again every day through people who call our district office and are desperate for help.
You hear that over and over again, right? And so I understand that the hearing yesterday, people were really frustrated in Sacramento. Lawmakers were really frustrated. What is to be done with EDD? Why is it so problematic?
Well, they're dealing with a multiplicity of problems, but I think their primary problem is that they have an information technology system that is decades old, is badly in need of refurbishment, and has been ignored. In a perfect world, our unemployment system would be one where people just got the benefits they needed by going online and filing a claim, where if more documentation was needed, they could upload it electronically, have it analyzed automatically, and be approved for their claim, and where if, God forbid, their claim was denied, they were given clear reasons for why the claim was invalid that didn't require speaking to a real person. So that's the kind of system that we need, where people can get instant relief and instant access to their government. And that's the kind of system that we're miles and miles away from having, unfortunately.
Yeah. So you say the system is decades old and has been ignored probably for as long. Who's to blame for that?
Oh, well, I mean, I think the EDD and the state of California are to blame. It's a problem that other states have, too, to be fair. These legacy systems are enormous monolithic bureaucracies, and it is difficult and time-consuming and expensive to update them, but it should have been done. If you want an idea of how bad things have gotten, a lot of our current unemployment insurance information system is written in the computer language of COBOL. And if you don't know how antiquated that is, that's a language that I learned in high school, and I won't tell you how old I am, but that was a while ago.
Right. So, yeah, many decades. but, you know, this is also a question of funding, right? And that funding does come from the state legislature, of which you're a part.
Yes, certainly. However, we have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on attempting to modernize the EDD over the last 10 years to no avail. And so now, hopefully, this is going to be a call to action to completely get rid of the old legacy system and build something new from scratch. If you look at the fact that California has been the crucible of many of the leading technology companies in the world, such as Apple, Google, Facebook, and yet the fact that we're still dealing with a legacy system written in a computer language that's 50 years old it boggles the mind.
Yeah. So why not give a contract to one of these tech companies in Silicon Valley to figure it out?
Well, that came up in the hearing yesterday. We have we don't do our own information technology with the EDD. The EDD uses a company called Deloitte, and that company has been paid hundreds of millions of dollars over the last 10 years, and I think that there's been a huge failure there. I think that we should give someone new a chance to see what can be done there. We have thousands of information companies that that make their homes here in California that are young, nimble, small, hungry, and I think they should be given a chance to modernize the system.
And what about staffing? You still need people, real people, to staff this, especially during this pandemic when millions of people are seeking benefits. Does the EDD need a lot more people there?
Absolutely. And they are trying, but it's been woefully inadequate. One of the things that came up at the hearing yesterday is the fact that there are actually two call centers that are spun up. There's the traditional call center, which handles questions about claims. And we were, a couple of months ago, infuriated to discover that that call center is only open Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to noon. And they spun up. Yes. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
We found out a couple of months ago when we complained about this, the EDD in response spun up a new call center that was staffed during traditional business hours. Unfortunately, we discovered in the intervening months that call center is only equipped to deal with very basic questions and can't answer specific questions about individual claims, which is, of course, the whole reason why people are calling. One of the things that came out of the hearing yesterday that just infuriated me was an admission by the EDD that there are only 100 operators in the call center that deals with claims. Only 100 for the entire state of California, a state with over 40 million residents. That is unacceptable.
Right, which is why we're hearing that story we heard earlier of she was calling. She made 700 calls in one day and didn't get through because
there
was no one there to answer.
Sure, and that's what people will do when they're desperate and they can't feed their children. Absolutely.
Okay, very quickly, do you support the state's effort to pass $600 in extra unemployment money?
Well, that's not a state effort. That's a federal effort. That's a
But California would step in and put more money in, I think, in case the federal effort doesn't go through, right?
Right. That's been a proposal. That's something that we're going to be looking at in the budget committee. The very first question I have is that legal? The loans that so to give your viewers and kind of an overview of how that would work. Right now, the California unemployment insurance system is insolvent. We don't have a balance left in our trust fund because of the high levels of unemployment in the state. So we are borrowing billions of dollars from the federal unemployment system through a process called a Title 12 loan. Those loans are loans that have to be paid back in the future. So it's not free money. And so my first question is it legal for us to expand unemployment benefits here in California and use those Title 12 loans to backstop those expanded benefits? And that's something that we'd have to look into before we consider doing it.
Well, hopefully that happens sooner rather than later because, well, people are desperate these days. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Absolutely. Yep. Thanks for elevating the topic.
Of course, that is Republican Assemblyman Jay Obernolte. He represents parts of San Bernardino. Coming up, we'll wrap our week-long series on education in the time of COVID with solutions for closing the learning gap. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to wrap up our week-long look at education in the time of COVID now with a conversation about how the virus is widening the already wide education gap between rich and poor students. But we'll also talk about some ideas for how to narrow it. Here to talk about this is Paul Tough. He's the author of the book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And also joining us is Annette Anderson. She's a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Education, where she does work with the university's Center for Safe and Healthy Schools. She's also a former teacher and principal in Baltimore. Welcome to the show, Annette.
Thank you.
And let's begin with you. How is the education gap widening for K through 12? What are you seeing?
Well, the first thing that I would say, Madeline, is that it's widening because of technology. We know that there already was a digital divide because of technology. And I think that what we're seeing is that that has increased because there has been less access for communities that were vulnerable before the pandemic hit. And now those communities continue to be vulnerable. The next thing that I would say in terms of the widening gap is that, you know, there has been this concern about access to strong instruction. I think a lot of the conversation about returning to school in the fall has been about how do we make sure that kids get robust, rigorous instruction. And so there's a concern because of how the pandemic forced schools to close in the spring, that particularly in communities of color and then in vulnerable communities, that they will not necessarily have access to the same depth of robust instruction that might be in other types of schools, like independent schools would have access to. So I think that there's a concern right there. And then I think it's also about the lack of access to trusted adults. And so one of the things that we saw is that schools form a lot of different purposes for students and their families beyond instruction. And so when the pandemic hit, you saw schools really stand in the gap for a lot of families vis-a-vis food access and housing access and also for health access. And so going back into the fall, I think there's concern that schools are going to be trying to just perform Herculean tasks with fewer resources. And we just want to make sure that every kid in the country has an equitable shot so that we don't have any delays down the lane for all kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the lack of access to trusted adults, that's mainly a function, I would imagine, of the fact that a lot of parents in low-income households have to go out and work, and they don't have the luxury to stay home and help their kids navigate Zoom or what have you.
I would agree with that. I would say that a lot of parents in households where there were essential workers, they were able to figure it out. It was not optimal, but you saw a lot of innovative and creative ideas around families, particularly using their kinship care and extended family units to help to provide child care and support for those families. So I think the concern is that, you know, there's this model of every kid in the United States in September sitting in front of a laptop or desktop computer with broadband and high speed internet and multiple devices. And I don't know that that is what we had this spring. And I don't know that we have invested enough to be able to get to some model like that in the fall if we're looking to have virtual learning. So it's something for us to think about.
Paul, what does this look like at the college level? How does the gap reveal itself there?
So the pandemic is definitely on the way to increasing the gap between well-off students and less well-off students in higher education. And it's happening on a lot of different levels at once. One of them is about admissions. So admissions is complicated this year because a lot of admissions decisions were made or being made just as the pandemic hit. But as I wrote about in my book, you know, more than we want to admit, a lot of admissions decisions at both public and private institutions are made based on the financial resources of families. You know, as state funding has been cut, a lot of institutions have to make their admissions decisions based on who can pay. And as budgets get hit for institutions, that pressure becomes even more intense. So I think there are more institutions that are looking for more well-off students and that are providing less financial aid, making it harder for poorer students to show up. I think it's also playing out on campus. You know, a lot of institutions have given very mixed messages to their students about whether college is going to be in person or a hybrid or online. And families with lots of resources are more flexible. They're able to change. Sure, you can be at home for a while, then you can go off to college. You can, you know, get your own apartment. You can adapt. And families without resources, it's just the chaos that they're getting from colleges has been much harder to deal with. The third way is about, I think the most important one is about state funding. Most funding for public higher education, which is where most college students go in the United States, comes from state budgets. And state budgets are in terrible shape right now across the country. And so we are already seeing budget cuts to public institutions that have suffered a lot of cuts already over the past decade or two. And that is going to, I think, prove to be a bigger and bigger problem as time goes forward.
And Annette, that's also a problem with K through 12 state funding.
Yes. Yeah.
Especially here in California, we've already dealing with a massive budget cuts to public education.
Yes, many states were already underfunded and schools were underfunded going into the pandemic. And so this has all just exacerbated an existing crisis. And so as you think about how schools are being asked now to fund their own PPE and fund, you know, the equipment that is going to be required to have socially distanced classrooms, to change furniture, to think about hiring additional staff that would be required to be able to implement a socially distanced return to in-person learning, there's a lot of concern about having sufficient funding to be able to make that happen.
Paul, what's going to happen to state university systems if they have to endure another round of budget cuts? There was, of course, the budget cuts from about 10 years ago from the Great Recession. Some of those were restored, at least here in California, but not nearly to the level they were pre the 2008 recession.
They're going to have to do two things, those institutions. One is that they're going to make different decisions in terms of admissions and aid, meaning that they're going to be able to admit and provide aid for fewer students with real needs. And the second is that they're going to provide fewer services for students. So that's going to affect how many classes are offered, how many classes are taught by adjuncts instead of full professors. And one of the things that we saw during the budget cuts a decade ago in the last recession was that some of the first cuts that get made in institutions of higher education are to student supports, things like mentors, advisors, guidance of all kinds. And that also has the effect of widening gaps because students who come from families where everyone's gone to college for generations, they need less help. They know how to work the system. They know how to make decisions about classes. First generation students, students who are the first in their families to go to college, they need that kind of advice. And when those cuts come, you often see that students who have more needs are more likely to drop out, less likely to succeed.
So let's get to the solutions part of this. Annette, what are you seeing as possible good news coming out of this, if there is any?
Well, one thing that I think we've been happy to start talking about is smaller class size. Ironically, you know, the ed reformers have been advocating for smaller class sizes for the last 30 years. And I think that in the next few months, we're going to have more serious conversations about how smaller class sizes can lead to improved learning outcomes for students. So I think that as we reconsider what a hybrid model or realistic socially distanced classrooms look like, I'm talking to people who are saying that probably not more than 8 or 10 in a classroom makes sense given the dynamics. And so we probably are looking at more at higher learning. I think that will come at a cost of us needing to hire more teachers. We are in the midst of a teacher shortage right now. And so I think that because of the economy, it might give us an opportunity to think about something like a Great New Deal where we would be able to hire more people to come into classrooms as second career or career changers into teaching and think about how we can support new incoming teachers to become strong in both virtual and face-to-face instruction, which is something that, you know, we've been talking about in education circles for a long time. So I think there are a few silver linings to this, and it would be great to see that out of this, our classrooms get smaller and the learning increase.
So, Paul, do you have any notes of optimism, or do you just see like a grim road ahead for higher education?
I have a couple. I do think that this coming year is not going to be great in higher education. It's going to be hard for everybody. The two silver linings that I see, one is sort of a big picture one, and one is more specific. The big picture one is so Annette mentioned, a New Deal. And I really think that that is what we need in public higher education. That's what we needed, I think, before this pandemic struck. And my hope is that this pandemic has persuaded more people that we need to really think differently about how we fund and provide higher education for people, especially those who can't afford huge tuition costs themselves. We just need to invest much more in public higher education. We need to have more young people getting the kind of training and education that college provides. We need a better educated workforce. All of those things have to happen if we're going to recover from this blow. So my hope is that there are more and more people who are coming to understand that, and that we're going to be able in the years ahead to commit more to public higher education. In a more immediate way, and this is a little bit contradictory, because mostly I'm talking about, you know, committing more money. But I do think that there may be some way that we are being forced to figure out better ways to use technology in higher education. Mostly distance learning is not working great for most students, and I think that's going to continue this year. But it could. It could work better than it is now. I think the residential college model is really important. There's a lot that students gain from being on campuses, being together for 4 years. But there are also a lot of students for whom that's not the right model, especially older students, students with families and jobs, a lot of the kind of students who are attending community colleges across the country. And if we were able to provide not just a sort of thrown together distance learning model, but a really well thought through distance learning model that had more flexibility, more support for students, but still let them get their education education more on their time and on their terms, I think we could really benefit a lot of students.
Is there a school that is doing it right now?
I don't think there's anyone who's completely figured it out. The institution that I've visited in my reporting that I was most impressed by was Southern New Hampshire University, which over the last decade or so has really reshaped itself as an institution where the residential population is just a small fraction of the students who are attending class there. So there are students all across the country who are taking online courses at Southern New Hampshire and who are mostly getting a good education at a reasonable cost. But they're also experimenting with this hybrid model where they work with groups in particular cities. I've seen it happen in Austin, Texas, where I live, where this organization called Peloton U works with Southern New Hampshire to provide an in-place sort of a storefront college where a few dozen students come for a few hours a day and do their online learning together. So they get the flexibility of the online model and the inexpensive tuition of an online model, but they also have a sense of community. They have advisors and supporters who are right there in the room with them. That to me feels like a model that could be replicated in lots of other places and through lots of other institutions.
And Annette, it seems like schools are also going to have to adjust, like K through 12 schools, public schools will also have to adjust and just be a lot more resilient and redefine themselves. And that could be a good thing too, as you're mentioning smaller class sizes, but also as places where the community can get together more than they have been in the past.
Yeah, I believe that schools are physical spaces, schools are buildings, but schools are also a set of experiences. And so, you know, as I'm listening to Paul talk about this Southern New Hampshire experience that they're giving students having a smaller space, I think that some schools will be able to open in the fall to host some specific activities for students, whether that is, you know, to have the chess club meet once a week or to have the debate club meet once a week or to provide special education services in a face-to-face venue. I think that there are some ways that schools, even those that are closed physically, can be open for some face-to-face experiences that give kids the connections that they need to the school building as a place where experiences take place that enrich their lives.
Annette Anderson is a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Education. Paul Tough is the author of the book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, former President Obama thinks the Trump administration will stop at nothing to disrupt voting this November.
Even undermining the Postal Service in the run-up to an election that's going to be dependent on mail-in ballots so people don't get sick.
Postal Service delays and how they could affect the election. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Have you noticed that your mail has been a little slow to arrive lately? Well, it's not your imagination. There is a backlog because of some changes recently made in Washington. And now some people are wondering if those changes were made in order to slow delivery to affect the November election, an election that will rely on mail-in ballots. Joining us to talk about this is Michelle Lee. She's a national political reporter for The Washington Post. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, what has changed at the Postal Service?
Well, there's a new Postmaster General. He took the job last month, and about 2 weeks ago, he rolled out a bunch of changes that he said were aimed at saving money for the Postal Service, which is mired in debt and has struggled financially for about a decade. Now, the things that are doing include shutting down sorting machines early, allegedly to save money. They're limiting when letter carriers can pick up mail to a very short window, and they stopped overtime pay. And as a result of these and other changes, postal workers across the country are telling us there's a days-long backlog, sometimes up to 4 days. And because there's no overtime pay, the backlog just keeps growing and growing because they can't cut it down. And they're raising a lot of concerns about the November election.
That backlog could just keep snowballing, affecting the mail-in ballots delivered maybe in September or October.
Right, exactly. We don't know how long these changes are going to be in place. It could be a couple more months. It could be permanent. But the issue, as you know, is that we're expecting a lot of mail-in ballots to be used by voters because of COVID. Yet the postal workers are already having trouble with the existing level of mail. And they prioritize election mail and ballots and making sure that sifts, you know, to the top from the piles and piles of mail. But if the backlog continues, then it's almost impossible to actually find those ballots in these bins and bins. So that's a major concern for them.
So what does this new Postmaster General, his name is Louis DeJoy, what does he say about that, about the accusations that this is in order to affect the election?
Well, Louis DeJoy himself has not actually addressed the accusations, but the Postal Service says that there's nothing political about this. He reports to a bipartisan board of governors, not to the president, and that these changes are aimed at saving money and stabilizing the
Well, it appears that we have lost Michelle Lee, the national political reporter for The Washington Post, and we'll try to get her back. Oh, she's back. Hey. Sorry, we lost you there. It's the casualty of our new way of doing business here.
Yeah.
So he's basically saying that there was no plot here to mess with the election. It's just a matter of trying to make the post office more financially sound.
Right. He's saying that this is simply to save money for the Postal Service and that any issues that come up in the short term are just temporary and that those issues will be all ironed out by the long-term stability of the organization. But the issue is we have an election coming up in just about 90 days or so, and any long-term gain that may come from this may come at the expense of a potentially chaotic election.
Adding to the fact that DeJoy was a big Republican contributor, right? He donated millions of dollars to Republican political committees.
Yes, he's not only a donor to President Trump, he is a longtime Republican donor, and he was actually the lead fundraiser for the GOP convention that's going to happen in just a few weeks. So he was a man in charge of raising money for the Republican convention to get the president reelected.
And the idea behind people saying, oh, this is about affecting the election, is that a lot of people think that Republicans don't like mail-in ballots. They think that that would disadvantage Republicans, although there really isn't that much evidence to support that.
There's very little evidence to support that.
Well, we are having some real technical difficulties here trying
to
connect with
Michelle Lee. It's susceptible to widespread fraud. But there's no evidence for that. And, you know, it's interesting because mail-in ballots used to be a method that both Democrats and Republicans liked because theoretically it increases access to voting for people who may have trouble getting to the polling place. And just a few years ago, it was not this politicized, but now we can see exactly how much of a political football it has become.
Yeah. Well, so is there any way around this? Could Congress earmark more money to hire more workers to dig out of this pile of mail that's piling up at post offices around the country?
Right. Postal workers are telling us that something has to change. Either the pay method has to come back to allow them to just work around the clock to drive this backlog down, or that the Postal Service needs to hire a bunch of more people. But these changes are aimed at cutting costs and saving what they're already spending on the Postal Service. So it's hard to imagine that the Postmaster General would all of a sudden, pay extra money to try to hire extra staff. However, there is a deal that's made with the Postal Service and the Treasury Department now to get the agency some access to emergency funding, at least in the short term, to try to cope with some of these issues. But, you know, the Postal Service needs so much more money than just the emergency funding.
And so if people are worried, really quickly, if people are worried about getting their mail-in ballot on time, what can they do?
Well, they should request it as early as possible, and they should turn it in as early as possible. Across the board, people are saying, please don't wait until the last day that you can turn in your mail-in ballot. Please turn it in at least 2 weeks before they're due. And if you don't get them about 3 weeks before the election, then you should contact your local election office and check out the status of your ballot and try to be on top of it so that you're not just waiting for the mail to show up just days before the election, because that won't be enough time to mail it back in.
Michelle Lieb is a national political reporter for The Washington Post. Michelle, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll have your Friday film reviews, including the latest from Beyoncé, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday. There's a lot to stream tonight, including Beyoncé's brand new visual album based on The Lion King, which we'll talk about at the end of this segment. So that's your dessert. Joining me is Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes, and Whitney Seibold, contributor at IGN and co-host of the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Hi, you guys.
Hi. Happy to be here on Beyoncé's internet.
Thank you.
Let's begin with The Fight, a new documentary that follows four of the nearly 200 cases the ACLU has brought against the Trump administration. Here's a bit from the trailer.
ACLU, good morning.
Hundreds of parents have just lost their kids.
Free our children now!
My job is to make sure the horror of what's going on stays front and center.
If we lose this case, I don't know what Roe versus Wade means.
If I'm not going to be a civil rights lawyer right now, in this moment, when?
Okay, so talk about these cases, Jacqueline. Which of these does the film profile?
Well, what's really interesting about The Fight is they follow some of the biggest headlines that the ACLU has been fighting recently. Everything from an undocumented woman, a minor, who is pregnant and is trying to seek an abortion, and the basically Homeland Security does not want to allow her to do to that because they're pro-life rather than giving her a constitutional right to an abortion, and everything else from voting rights, voter ID laws, to the Muslim ban, which is sort of the case that sort of kicks off the film, if you will. And essentially, it's incredible to see how these lawyers sort of persevere against really insurmountable odds and the Trump administration, where they essentially have made them work harder than they ever anticipated to do. One of the lawyers had said that he planned to take time off, and then the election happened, and he realized that he was probably never going to see his family again.
Oh, boy. So it definitely has a point of view. It's pro-ACLU, this documentary.
Yes, and I think it's pro-liberty. It's pro-rights. And so whether or not you necessarily agree with the politics, I think everyone can respect the passion and perseverance that these lawyers approach, because you're seeing real, actual people.
So, Whitney, what did you think?
This is a really sweet, very personal documentary. I appreciate the way the three directors were able to sort of position the ACLU as regular people fighting for regular rights that we should all be expecting against this big sort of Goliath machine that is essentially seeking to very actively dismantle a lot of aspects of decent humanity. We see sort of news clips of the Trump administration at work and some of their really brazen, not really well thought out racist policies. And we get to see the ACLU offices where people are just sort of very put upon. They're sort of drinking coffee, showing off their tattoos, and really trying to find the most decent path through these really horrible weeds that are put in front of them. In choosing four cases, it almost seems like they'd be spreading themselves thin, but that was a really wise approach because we got a good cross-section as to everything the ACLU is working toward without having to go down deep into all the hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits that have been brought against the Trump administration.
And the ACLU wins some and it loses some. And so does it portray the ups and the downs?
It does. There's even a really wonderful scene near the end where one of the lawyers' cases, they're successful, but they don't know they're successful at first. They have to sort of read through a Supreme Court ruling to see how well they did. But there's also a lot of frustrations along the way. We do get to see some of the cases fall apart in a way that is really upsetting, especially in the transgender ban in the military.
Yes.
And how frustrating it was, how what they had to prove in court, and things that just didn't stand in the eyes of the legal system. And we get to see sort of the heartbreak that they're constantly experiencing as well.
Moving on to Summerland, this is a feature debut from director Jessica Swale, and it's about a writer who's asked to take in a young evacuee from London during World War II, and here's a bit from the trailer.
This is Miss Lam, your new guardian.
I don't want him. We've all got to do our bit.
Do you believe in heaven?
Yes.
Well, you shouldn't.
What happened to all the people who died before the Christians? Where did their souls go?
Summerland.
Where's Summerland?
It's a myth.
Stories have to come from somewhere.
All right, Whitney, you saw this. What's the plot of this movie?
Well, Gemma Arterton plays a cantankerous author who's living in the British countryside during World War II, as you said. She is forced to, kind of without her consent, take on a young lodger, a young boy named Frank, during just following the Blitz. And it's about how she very begrudgingly eventually forms a bond with this young boy over her writing and over their mutual interest in this mythic place called Summerland that she's writing a novel about. She's very cagey, however, because we get to see some flashbacks about how she's come to be so lonely and so grumpy is because of a failed affair from years before with Gugu Mbatha-Raw, and how they had big plans to live together, but it was not acceptable for two women to marry and have a family. So it just sort of fell apart, and now she's really, really grumpy. It's a very sweet story. I think it's a very humane story. It feels very much a showcase for Gemma Arterton's acting. Jessica Swale, who directed this, was previously a playwright and a play director, and has worked with Gemma Arterton before. So I feel like it's more of a fun dramatic exercise between actor and director. We get Gemma Arterton a lot of really wonderful moments where she can just do actually things and prove to the world, for goodness sake, that she is worth paying attention to. Gemma Arterton has been popping up in American films here and there. If you ever saw the film Their Finest, you know how great she can be. And this is just another example of how wonderful this actress is.
So you liked it. You liked this movie.
I did like this movie. It does have a little bit too tidy of an ending. There are some coincidences at the end that might read as a bit contrived. Everybody's connected in a way that you wouldn't expect. But that doesn't bog the film down necessarily. It's not super corny. It's actually, to repeat the word, really very sweet.
All right, let's move on to The Secret, Dare to Dream, based on that best-selling self-help book. It stars Katie Holmes. Here's a clip from the trailer.
I can't afford a new roof.
Let me help.
Why are you helping me?
Oh, because I can.
How do you know Miranda?
I don't really.
Why are you fixing her roof?
She doesn't love him. Not like Dad.
All your dad ever wanted was for you to be happy.
How would you know that?
Okay, Jacqueline, what do you have to say about this?
So The Secret is based on a documentary that they then made into a book, and now we have to have this film, which the best thing I could say is I was happy to see Katie Holmes and Josh Lucas and briefly, you know, Jerry O'Connell for a bit, you know, my faves from the late 90s and the early 2000s. It was nice in that respect, but watching Katie Holmes play this debt-riddled mom who essentially, by positive thinking, is going to change her life is so hard for the cynic in me to suffer through. I have dreamed of marrying Bill Hader for the better part of two decades, and that has not happened, no matter how much positive thought I put behind it. So I don't necessarily prescribe to the thoughts of The Secret. It is something that was sort of foisted upon us by Oprah's book club and has been sort of derided ever since. I don't know if I've forgiven Oprah for giving it to us.
The trailer took me a long time to get through. It just seemed endless.
Oh, well, gosh, try Whitney. Sitting through the feature.
God.
Jacqueline compared it to cotton candy. I'd say it's more like deep fried corn in that it's like you'll take a bite, you'll know it's a mistake, and it'll just weigh in your stomach all day. This is one of the most contrived, horrendously plotted Hollywood weepies that you could possibly get underneath the PG rating. It's about a like Jacqueline said, a debt-ridden mom, but it also has that wonderful old Hollywood cliche of the flawless rescued stud, which is the male equivalent of the manic pixie dream girl, this fellow who exists only to improve the life of the female protagonist and always gives of himself and does things like fix her roof, but he's completely non-threatening. And he's played by Josh Lucas, so he's just handsome enough without being too sexy. It's...
Shade.
He's no Bill Hader. He's no Bill Hader.
Hey.
Okay, let's move on to something that looks a lot more promising. This is Beyoncé's new visual album, Black is King. It came out on Disney Plus today. And even though we don't typically review music videos, this is a special case because really it's not a video. It's a full-length movie. And here's a bit from the trailer.
Life is a set of choices.
Does your father know you are here?
Lead.
I laugh in the face of danger.
Or be led astray.
Run away. And never return.
Follow your light or lose it.
Okay, Jacqueline, let's begin with you. The album was inspired by the new Lion King film. And then what does she do with that premise?
Well, first, let's talk about the fact that Beyoncé has made Disney bend to her, because she not only first released The Lion King, The Gift, which has many of the songs that the Black is King has in it, but then she then went out for a year and shot Black is King, which is this visual album that takes the songs from that and sort of retells the story of Simba across the diaspora of the Black experience. And she employs tons of African and Black artists throughout the world with incredible visual and really a style that is not only in celebration of the film The Lion King, but more importantly, the celebration of Black culture throughout the world. And yes, I will say it as a Black woman, I do love Beyoncé. I just think that she's amazing. But this is a very compelling and really stunning visual album.
Well, she has unlimited money, it seems, anyway, right? It's not yes. hard for her to do that.
No, not at all. And she got some great guest stars, like her daughter and her son, Kelly Rowland, Naomi Campbell, and Lupita Nyong'o. So she definitely employs the right folks to come join her on this.
Whitney, what did you think?
As a tie-in to The Lion King, I think Beyoncé was really wise in steering away as much as she possibly could from the story of the actual film. Black is King does incorporate dialogue from The Lion King, but only in a very cursory way. She is attempting to create a sort of narrative, but I think it's much stronger when it becomes much more of a polemic about personal power, when it becomes a little bit more of the philosophy of African pride. One of the opening numbers is about how proud she's going to be to teach her children about their African heritage and how proud she is of her own African heritage and how inspiring that is. It does go off on some weird tangents. There are some numbers that I think are kind of forgettable. But when she's focusing more on full-bore music video visuals, when she is just allowed to let the artistry take over, dress like she's going to the Met Gala mixed with Cirque du Soleil, that's when Black is King, I think, is really the most fascinating.
I'll forgive you for that. Look, I agree with you, Whitney. Even as someone that did like the album that it's based off of, I'm not going to say every single song on it is a bop, But I do think every other frame is a picture. I mean, that could be a Zoom background for there will be Zoom backgrounds of shots from Black is King. And I'm not just talking about the ones that I've already saved to my background. But no, look, is it an Oscar award winning film? No, but I think if you honestly even diluted it down even further to maybe the best bits of it, this is an absolutely compelling piece of art that you could watch with the sound off, and I think you would still find it to be interesting.
All right. Something positive to end on. Thank you. Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes, Whitney Seibold, contributor at IGN, and co-host of the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Have a great weekend. Thank you both.
Thanks for
having
us. Thank you. This that lightning, this that bar, this ain't no power. This that nappy, this that herb, this that kinfolk, this that skinfolk, this that war, this that bloodline on the front line, ready for war. Mm.
My Power off Beyonce's latest album, Black is King. And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, and Catherine Barnes, and Nihar Patel. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Ta is our digital producer. Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards are our technical directors. Don't forget, you can subscribe to our podcast if you want. It's at kcrw.com. or get it wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brandt. I'll take a few days off. Jonathan Bastian will be with you next week. So have a great weekend.